broadband internet service providers in Real Simple Syndication are proud to bring you
Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night.
Why, hello, listeners. Welcome back to another exciting episode of Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night. That is Jordan.
And that is Carlin.
And thank you for joining us. Today, we are going to talk about a little selection that Jordan made called Only God Forgives.
Yes. Only God Forgives. This movie actually appeared... We'll start off with a warning to listeners. This movie is controversial. So,
this podcast will be as well, then.
This podcast will probably have some things to say. I found this movie to be very interesting, and Carlin did not.
Go ahead and go over the intro stuff that we usually do, and then I will give you a good quote summing my feelings up.
Okay, so the Netflix summary, and I don't, by the way, I've commented about how I feel about the accuracy of Netflix summaries in the past. I don't think this one is as accurate as it could be. When a cop kills the brother of a British gangster who runs a Bangkok fight club, his crime boss mother flies from London to supervise revenge. Okay, it doesn't say anything about London in the entire movie.
No.
And the characters are not British. They're American. It's made pretty clear that they came from America.
Some of the small characters are from the UK.
A few of them are, but not all of the characters. Anyway, that's my rant about this. It was written and directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, which is an interesting last name. He's actually a Danish director.
He did an amazing film called Bronson.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
I've seen parts of it. That's the one with Tom Hardy, if I'm...
As the
fighter Bronson.
First of all, Tom Hardy is awesome in that role. Second of all, the script is awesome.
Yeah.
It's directed so well. It is a phenomenal film. Definitely recommend Bronson. I know, I'm pretty sure it's on Netflix at the moment,
too.
It is. And anyone out there, if you've wanted to see Tom Hardy's penis, you can see it.
That's not what I was going to say about Bronson. That movie actually was what convinced me that Tom Hardy could be Bane.
Oh, yeah.
Because
he is so muscly in that movie.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
Like, ridiculous. He did an awesome job. He is a crazy good actor.
Some other movies that Refn has been a part of was something called the Pusher Trilogy. Those movies are probably his biggest claim to fame. He also did a kind of weird, bizarre fantasy movie called Valhalla Rising. And also, he did the thriller Drive, which has some relation to this movie that we're going to be talking about. Speaking of that, the actors for this movie, Ryan Gosling was the main protagonist, viewpoint character of this movie. He played the character of Julian. And of course, Gosling is very famous for movies like The Notebook, The Ides of March. The Ides of March is fantastic. Have you seen that yet?
Yes.
Oh, that's a good movie.
I did enjoy that. That's a good one.
And also Lars and the Real Girl, which is probably one of my favorite movies that Gosling has done. It also has Kristen Scott Thomas as Julian's mother. Her name is Crystal. She's been in a bunch of things as well. Four Weddings and a Funeral, as well as The English Patient and The Other Boleyn Girl, where she was The Other Boleyn Girl. And then this movie was shot all in Thailand, so it does have... Forgive me here. Vithaya Pansringarm, if I'm not totally butchering.
Pansing in his name there?
It's Pansringarm.
Got it.
So it's P-A-N, like a pan, which comes into the later end of the movie.
It does.
And he is playing the police inspector, Lieutenant Chang. He's been in a couple other movies. He was in The Last Executioner and a movie called The White Storm. Probably his most famous movie in the United States, sadly to admit, is The Hangover Part 2.
All right.
Yeah. And the film, and I think this is important to point out, it's not an American movie, and it's not a Thai movie. It's a movie that was funded by Denmark and France in a collaboration. So you've got an interesting thing going on there.
Did they know what they were funding, is the question.
Probably. I'm assuming that Refn had to submit like some kind of treatment to the funding boards.
So is this the time for me to tell you my good quote?
I would love to hear your good quote.
So I always take notes when we watch these films for the podcast. And towards the end of watching Only God Forgives, I wrote a quote down because I was I had to get my feelings out properly on paper.
Now, this is a quote that you came up with?
Yes. This is my personal quote. I wrote, "Only God forgives, but he will not forgive Refn for making this pile of shit." And that is an accurate portrayal of how I feel about this film. It is horrendous. There are no redeeming qualities to this film. It was bad when it was written, it was bad when it was shot, and it sucks even worse when you watch it.
Why?
Terrible.
Why?
Okay.
I have another quote here. I'm gonna write this down.
Okay. "It seems over-dramatized and ridiculously drawn out." This basically looked to me, I've seen a lot of Asian film, and I love properly done Asian films. Mm-hmm. This looks like Refn watched a bunch of really good gangster-style Asian films.
Yes.
And said, "I want to do that. I think I can do that." And then just threw something together that has zero-dimensional characters, has the most basic plot I've ever seen in a film like this, has no interesting visuals, has only violence to it. It was basically only a vehicle for violence. And there's, you know, something, Jordan, that you had harped on with Roger Dodger. There is absolutely no character development in this film for anyone. And all the characters are scumbags.
Yes,
they which are. I will point out, I'm not against having a film where all the characters are scumbags, as long as it's done properly, as long as it's interesting. You know, if it's a film where it's just a glimpse into a scumbag world, and it's done properly, and the script is well written, the plot's good, the dialogue's good, whatever, awesome. You know, I'm all for it. But this was a case where everyone's a scumbag, and it just, it was written horribly. The characters are terrible. There's a lot of awful, awful acting in this, too. And mainly the mother, the gangster mother, her acting was just so over-the-top bad. I couldn't believe it. My wife was half-watching, and she was like, "This lady's terrible." I mean, someone not even paying attention can tell.
Yeah.
It's bad. I also wanted to say, did Ryan Gosling read the script before he said yes to this?
He only had 17 lines worth of dialogue to it.
Yeah, he didn't talk, but I've seen a lot of movies with him, and they're always good. I don't understand why he chose this film, because it is so awful.
Did you see Drive?
Yes.
It's the same director. Same writer and director. So they might have done it as like a we like working together type of collaboration.
And I could see some influence from Drive in Only God Forgives. He's, you know, the director, writer-director, is trying to do a lot of slow-pacing stuff.
Yes.
The characters walk slow. They talk slow. This film was a staring contest, basically. There's a lot of time in this film where characters are just looking at each other, not speaking. There's a lot of non-sequiturs in this film. It's just, nothing works. Nothing works for me. Nothing about this film. No redeeming qualities. It's garbage. And that's how I feel.
Okay.
Refn, you fucked up. Real bad.
You got a lot of notes there for just that.
I know. I'll throw in other stuff here and there.
Okay. So I kind of saw this movie a little bit differently. I saw it as a movie that is all about people using other people as commodities.
That's exactly what is happening.
Right.
Definitely.
You know, and the thing is that I think that choosing Thailand as a setting for that movie is a very interesting decision.
Well, they make it look like the only thing in Thailand is strip clubs and whorehouses.
But that's the what is the biggest thing that Thailand is known for?
Well, that, but my point is, we always harp on stereotypes.
We do.
And this is a prime example of using a stereotype for an entire country.
But is it using a stereotype for that country to talk about the country itself? Or is it using that stereotype to talk about our perception of what that country actually is?
I don't think that it was talking about our perception. I just think it was using it as a convenient... It was using the stereotype as a convenient setting for the story that the writer wanted to tell. That's my thought on it. Because he was just basically like, okay, I have this idea of this story in my mind where this is what happens.
Right.
What place is known for being like that?
Really horrible.
Thailand. Okay, well, then I'm going to set it there.
Well,
he could have created some fictitious place.
He could have. I mean, it could have been a completely fantasy movie. Which fantasy movies that try and deal with that kind of thing can be a double-edged sword, because they can either succeed and people understand what you're trying to do, or they can completely fail. And I'm wondering if this version of Bangkok that we're seeing on film is more of a fantasy than an actual, you know, or an actual reality. And I think that's why a lot of people respond so viscerally to this film. They either hate it or they love it, because they don't see the fantasy aspect, and they just see it as a stereotype, or they get that aspect of it's supposed to be a fantasy world where people are using each other as commodities, and we're looking and seeing how this is affecting the main character of Julian. Because at the very beginning of the movie, Julian is perfectly okay with what's going on with the people around him. He's perfectly fine with consistently hiring out a prostitute. He's consistently fine with using a Muay Thai arena. And by the way, Muay Thai is
fighting style.
Thailand kickboxing, essentially. Yeah. He's
passing out drugs in the fights.
Yeah, personally okay with passing out drugs during the fights and getting money for the drugs. He seems to be okay with all of this. And also we should point out that Julian isn't the only one there doing this stuff. He actually has a brother named Billy. And Billy is a much worse person than Julian. I guess you're talking about bad in terms of degrees here.
Yeah, because everyone is bad.
But everyone is bad. But it's a different kind of bad. Because
it's like absolutely no humanity.
Yes. Like Billy is essentially there to mess things up. And yeah, I mean that he's in a the very worst possible kind of way. He's an animal.
He's a very anarchist type person.
Yes. Yes.
Doesn't care, and he just wants to do everything he wants to do when he wants to do it, regardless. And he's pretty evil.
Right. Right. He is... I think Billy is an example of evil incarnate.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, where he is not willing to change who he is or anything about himself.
Well, they make it so obvious that he is...
And it's not even... Well, they don't even give him enough time on the screen to be anything but evil.
Exactly. Well, and it's immediately established how evil he is when he says that he wants to have sex with a 14-year-old.
Yes.
There is no way in film to make an audience hate someone faster than doing something like that.
Right.
And...
Well, no, there is another way, and that's using the N-word, which then comes up in this movie.
Well, that,
and
also
well.
Killing animals.
Yes.
There's another one.
Yeah. Were any animals killed in this movie?
I don't think so.
I think they out of the trifecta, they missed one.
I saw a limping dog.
Yeah,
but nobody hurt him.
But actually, Julian shows compassion to that dog. He's actually giving it food.
Oh, I didn't see that. I don't remember that portion. I may have just shut down at that point.
I think he might have. That was like only a half hour into the movie, too.
Damn, I hated this film.
Okay, so you said that the color, like, there were no interesting visuals in this movie.
Not interesting enough, because everything is red, pretty much all the time, pretty much.
Everything is either red or blue.
Yeah, good and bad.
No, not good and bad. Assuredness and anxiety.
Okay.
Because what I am seeing here... is that, like, when Bill, like, what we have in the very beginning of the film is we have two Muay Thai combatants.
Mm-hmm.
And they're wearing, you know, the boxing shorts and everything. One is wearing red and one is wearing blue. And it's pretty much shown that how the film is going to pay out, in that the person who is always assured of what they are doing is going to come out on top when red KOs blue. Just totally knocks him out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just seen in the background as Julian is walking through.
Right.
So some examples of the color technique that's used to show this is that Billy wears a red shirt, you know, because he is assured in his place in this world. He is here to mess things up and to take whatever he wants and call it his.
And then, like, the strip clubs and the whorehouses are all bathed in red light.
They are. Except for this one scene when Billy is talking about how he wants to have sex with a 14-year-old. He is sitting in a strip of blue, showing how he is not really finding what he wants in the strip club. So then he has to go... Well, first off, when you can't find what you're looking for in the brothel, you have to beat up the prostitutes. Because that's what any self-assured Machiavellian masochist does. You know, so...
Either I'm getting what I want, or these prostitutes are getting...
Exactly. Beat. So he totally, you know, just smashes everybody's face in. Because what he wants, his assured nature is that he wants what he can control. And because he cannot find what he can control... The blue is representing the anxiety that he feels there. So he destroys the place, and then he goes off looking for what he can find to control and to destroy. You know? And so then another example of red being used as a symbol of assuredness is the back room of the Mai Tai Palace. We'll just call it that because I can't think of any... Or the gym where the Mai Tai actually occurs. It's actually pretty sumptuous for Jim. There's this gorgeous wallpaper, the lights are there and everything like that. Everything is red. And this is where Julian feels safe. You know, he feels safe in knowing that he is in his place. And what's also interesting is that he has a real sexual hang-up. He doesn't like touching his prostitute. He likes watching her touch herself.
Right.
You know, so what does he have her do? He has her tie him up with a red ribbon, showing how even though he's given up his power, he is in a safe place.
He's safe being restrained.
Exactly. You know,
and is that maybe he's safe being restrained because he doesn't want to be like his brother?
No, that's because he's afraid of being like his mother. Because his mother and his brother are exactly alike.
Right.
And in fact, it's pretty strongly hinted that Crystal has incestuous relationships with both of her children.
Yeah, that's pretty strong.
So the idea that he doesn't want to be like his mother. He doesn't want to be like his brother. Two people who are incredibly transgressive. So what does he do? He still needs this human connection that we're all looking for. But rather than force himself onto somebody and put himself into a position where he is taking somebody else's power, he makes them tie him up so he can feel safe in enjoying what he wants.
Right.
Another thing that you notice later on in the film is that the prostitute, he seems to only frequent one prostitute, a girl named Mai. Mai, when he approaches her, is wearing a blue dress. And that to me is showing, because what he is doing at that point is Julian is asking Mai to come meet his mother because he knows it's going to be a horrible situation at this dinner party. Crystal is just off the chain.
Yeah.
You know, she's always off the chain.
Yeah.
She is a horrible person who he doesn't want to confront alone. So he takes Mai a beautiful dress and gives it to her and asks her to go and pretend to be his girlfriend. But
Crystal sees through that pretty immediately.
Oh, pretty quickly. You know, because she makes the assumption that when Mai says that she's an entertainer, that she's a prostitute, which is true.
Yeah.
And then she spends a whole bunch of time verbally assaulting Mai in this restaurant, which... is a place of assuredness for Crystal, as indicated by all of the red behind her, and the fact that for them to come into the scene, both Mai and Julian have to pass through two vases that are filled with red flowers. So do you see where I'm coming from?
I do, and that's interesting, and I'm glad you picked up on that, because that is an interesting aspect to what was done. But still, my issue is the storyline. You know, what there's nothing interesting about the storyline. You can have that great use of color and have really interesting meaning to the change in colors. But if you don't have a plot that works and a story that works, you have nothing. You know, it's just like Panos Cosmatos when he did Beyond the Black Rainbow. There were a lot of things that he did well. You know, the 80s feel that he put to it was outstanding. Mm-hmm. The color, his color uses were really great. He did, had a lot of awesome visuals. But we harped on it because the story was not there. It was a terrible story. It was sloppy. It just meant nothing, basically. And I feel the same way about Only God Forgives.
What if the pacing is another story technique that's showing what's going on in Julian's mind?
It only had one pace, though.
Slow.
Yeah, everything was because slow. Is he mentally slow?
No, he's not mentally slow. But he has been so inundated in this culture of violence and assuredness that he cannot figure out how to rise to the top until the very end of the movie. You know, so the first thing that he experiences is this dream about his brother.
Which, I will say, there are tons and tons and tons of dream sequences in it, but they're like daydreams.
Right, they're not.
They don't seem to connect very well with what's actually going on. Like, the cutting between what's happening and the dream nightmare sequences screw up flow. What flow there is of the film. It screws it up greatly, and I just think those were poorly done. That was another one of my notes.
Right.
You said that. I have a lot of notes.
Yeah, you do. You got like an entire page. But what I see is Julian, you know, and this is where the fantasy aspect comes in with the dream sequences, is that Julian is able to
exercise his mind,
and also, you know, find. He's trying to find out who he is.
It's going through his thought process.
Yes. So he's thinking about his brother, and then it's reported to him that his brother is killed. So his immediate reaction is what his mother would do. He tracks down the guy who kills his brother. And Billy was actually killed by the father of the prostitute who Billy had actually murdered.
Yeah, and, because the police officer was like, "Hey, here, do what you want to this guy."
And this is my idea of people being used in this film as commodities, tied up in threefold. Billy uses the girl, and he kills her. Mm-hmm. And then when the cop finds out what happened, he brings the father in, and he then just unleashes the father on Billy.
Right.
And the father kills Billy. And then the cop, having one, now that he's used the father, drags him to an abandoned part of town and asks him, "Why were you letting your daughter be a prostitute?" And he's like, "I have three other daughters. I needed the money." Mm-hmm. So he was using his daughter as a commodity as well. And then the cop, the lieutenant, is a monster. He is an absolute freaking monster. Mm-hmm. And his favorite weapon is the sword. And he lops off the guy's arm. But when Julian goes to confront the father, he's planning on killing him. It's straight up clear that the father is not going to make it out alive. And then Julian asks him, and this is the scene that I was talking about with the dog. This happens right before. Julian is feeding this dog some meat or something, and just kind of playing with this dog. And then the father goes into the house, and Julian's interpreter goes in the house, and then Julian does, and the dog just kind of walks off the screen. Mm-hmm. And they close up the house, and Julian goes, "Why did you kill my brother?" The father only explains the part that Julian murdered his daughter. You know, so then, not really with the full story, Julian starts to feel that justice is done and his brother did something horrible. And so now he's trying to accept what happened to his brother was something that should have happened to his brother because of the consequences of his brother's actions. Mm-hmm. So he goes for the rest of the movie is him trying to push against his mother in a very inadequate way, to trying to make it clear to, like, trying to make it clear to his mother that he is his own person and he is thinking his own way. So he does not go after the police officer. He does not go after the father at that point. He is trying to get back to business as usual, which of course is twisted, but he is trying to make a distinction of Billy did something awful. He got what he deserved. We don't need vengeance because right. he got the justice that he deserved, which is arguably not true. But in the concept of the gangster's mind, what Julian is actually portraying in the movie is fairly sophisticated, in my opinion.
You find this story interesting? I mean, I understand that you're laying out all these meanings, but when it comes down to it, the execution is so poor. It's not compelling. This film, it could not hold my interest. It just didn't work. I mean, I understand the ideas, but the story itself is a blah story. It's a cliche. I mean, it's cliche after cliche after cliche thrown in there as far as Asian film goes. And there's no interesting twist to anything. Not a single shred of it. That's all I can say about that. There's no interest to be had in watching this film. I mean, technically speaking, I you know, cinematography-wise, they did a good job framing shots and everything. I'm sure Ryan Gosling did the acting he was asked to do accurately. It's just, you know, these characters were all emotionless. At no point do you see emotion.
I think you do.
Okay, in very, very rare occasions, and it's usually side characters that show emotion. But the main characters, all the main characters, other than Crystal, which I don't even know if she's, like, totally a main character, they don't show emotion. They're usually deadpan, nothing on their face, and they walk slowly, and they do everything slowly.
I think
characters are not believable. None of them are believable. Not even close. It's just, there wasn't a believable story made here at all. On any level, there's no believable story woven. It's, you know, the dream sequences take you out of it. The score is so mismatched in so many areas. There's a lot of the time where it's even silent when there should be something to give people cue to know how to feel about it, because there's no emotion there. But then again, maybe that is a tactic where they're basically saying, you know, you have to fight through it to figure out for yourself how you feel, or maybe you should feel what Julian feels being confused. You know, he doesn't have the music in the film to give him a cue as to how he should feel about it. But, you know, you can do all these interesting things and use these techniques, but when it comes down to it, was it written properly? Was it executed properly? Was the story from the get-go compelling? My argument would be that there was never a compelling story there.
Well, then how would you make the story more compelling?
Create a different one.
How so?
That's the problem. Well, to start, you could show struggle more. You could actually show emotion within some of the characters. And mainly Julian, obviously, because he is the main character. You could show him starting to struggle with the issue of his brother being dead, because you don't really see him being upset about that. But then you can also show him struggling somehow with the issue of, now I'm struggling because I feel like, you know, I'm okay with him being dead, and that's not right. But then him struggling with that and then finally coming to the realization, you know, that's fine for me to feel that way because that's the right thing ultimately. You know, actually frame scenes that demonstrate the struggles that are going on. At no point in the film are they really showing the audience that any of these characters are having struggles. And one of the things that I wrote down towards the end of the film, there's the moment when Julian decides that his mother had said to kill everyone in where the lieutenant lives. The lieutenant, his family, all of them, and there's a young child there. So a bunch of people do get killed, and Julian's against killing the child. So he kills the hitman that his mother hired so that he won't kill the child. And to me, from everything that had been shown in that film, there are no feelings or actions that predicate him stopping that from happening. It was a switch to morality that's out of thin air. that happens just like the flick of a switch. Because his character was so emotionless throughout the whole thing, and you never really saw any real struggle.
I did see struggle, though. You know, because, like...
I saw zero.
I mean, like... One of the things that's the struggle for me is, like, when Mai is asking him, why do you let your mother put up... Why do you let your mother treat you this way? You know, he like, forces her against the wall. And this is, like, the only thing that he does towards another character who
violently.
Yeah, that's... Well, I mean, shooting somebody in the head is pretty violent.
Right.
But this is, like, the one time in the movie that he's not going against the cop. Like, going against someone who is directly opposed to him in a violent manner. You know, and he basically backs her against the wall and said, because she's my mother. In other words, I feel like a lot of what he's been doing, what's happened to him is that he's been programmed.
Right.
By a pretty monstrous person.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of discussed a little bit later in the movie when Crystal says that she has, like, that Billy was was a son essentially after her own heart, you know, and that there had been complications with Julian's birth, and she was told by people to abort the pregnancy, and she didn't. And she essentially says, man, I wish I had. You know, mm-hmm. I would have rather had just Billy and no other son than a son who disappoints me so much. You know, but the thing is, you know, I think for the beginning part of the movie, Julian doesn't want he wants to be the son that his mother loves. He can't, because it's not really his personality. But that's what he's been essentially brainwashed into thinking. You know, so when he's put into this position, you know, where someone directly challenges him to think differently about his situation, he doesn't know how to respond. And so he treats Mai in a very horrible way. Essentially makes her take off the dress that he had given her and makes her walk through the rest of the city in nothing but her underwear.
Mm-hmm. Which, it is interesting to point out that there was no nudity in this film. Well, except there was a nude dead body, but...
There was a nude dead
body. But you couldn't... It didn't really focus on that. You couldn't really see so much. Covered in blood and all.
But the thing is then that... He's trying to process it. And he tries very hard to be the son that his mother wants him to be when he actually tries to go head-to-head with the lieutenant. And it's actually implied in the movie that the lieutenant had trained at that Mai Tai school and was actually a very good fighter. It was implied in some scenes where the police came to question Julian, and he went to talk to the officers, and the lieutenant was watching the people in the ring, and the locals recognized him and showed him a lot of signs of deference. Not because he was a police officer, but because of who he was in the dojo, in the fighting palace. So then when they come back later, Julian this scene with Mai has sparked a conflict in him that he doesn't know how to resolve. And so he tries, and then this other scene with his mother talking about how she just wishes that he had been aborted. He's trying to be the son that she wants him to be.
Mm-hmm.
And to say that she's ridiculously overacting is not a far stretch. It's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
But Julian is trying to live within the context that is set up within the film. And the thing is that he is pushing really hard to be that son, and then he gets the snot beat out of him, and his mother essentially just turns her back on him.
Yeah.
And doesn't do anything.
Because he didn't perform right. as she expected he
exactly.
would or should.
He, so that rejection by his mother then frees him to rebel in the more obvious way of saving the lieutenant's daughter. You know, so it's not, and also the scene, the lieutenant does seem to really care about his daughter. You know, that is something where I would say mm-hmm. that he really does show a lot of emotion.
I don't really think he shows.
In the context of the movie.
In the context of the movie, but in the context of actually showing ever emotion, he, you know, the problem is every single character has one mode. One mode. And that's one of the problems with why it's so hard for an audience member to feel invested in any of the characters. Because, first of all, they're all scumbags. Second of all, they're all emotionless, basically. And third of all, they all just embody one mode, like one thing. And then that's it. Except for, I guess, the lieutenant who shows, you know, that he actually has some sense of good, but he's also a terrible person.
The thing that strikes me about the lieutenant is his obsession with karaoke.
Yeah, that just seemed very, for no reason, just tacked on. Just
well, to me, it was again getting back to subjugation. He was exerting his authority over his squad by making them watch him perform after he had violated somebody with a sword. Because pretty much every time that he goes and chops off a limb or opens somebody up from stern to stomach, and then when he kills Crystal in the end of the movie, he then goes back
and does the same thing.
It's the ritual of a serial killer.
Right. I don't know, just none of this is compelling to me at all. I mean, it's all... The thing is that this I've seen this story so many times, you know? Like, the same type of story, and it's always been so much better done, and it's actually been engaging. And the way it was executed, you know, there wasn't a fantastic story to tell in the first place. So when you take a simple story that's already been done before, and then you add all these tricks to how you're going to tell that story... That's not straightforward, that doesn't engage people, you lost me. And you probably lost a lot of people. It really seems to me like this film was for Refn and Refn only. You know, he was just making it because he had an idea and he wanted to do it, much like Panos Cosmatos. You know, I have some money, I would like to do this film that I think is awesome, and it's just for me.
Yeah.
And that's what this seemed like to me. I mean, I'm glad that you were able to find excitement in this film and find all sorts of cool meanings and everything, but even when you're pointing it out to me, it means absolutely nothing, because watching it and thinking about what the story is and what actually happened, no reaction from me, because it's unremarkable on every level. There's nothing to say. Like, there's nothing to say in this film. The writer-director had nothing compelling to present and nothing to comment on. It was just, it was blah, it was terrible, it was
so what,
it's nothing.
You keep on saying that you've seen movies that do this better. What are some recommendations?
Not the exact same story, but the same style of story. Bangkok Dangerous, which actually does happen in Thailand. It is a Thai film, so you don't see just all, you know, brothels and stuff like that. But it's been a while since I've seen it, but there's that kind of some of that stuff in there. Ichi the Killer is actually a very stunning example, because you have some very terrible people in there, but they actually will show emotion. And I think that story is very well executed. That's a Japanese film by Takashi Miike. I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know who did Bangkok Dangerous. Was it the Pang brothers, maybe, who did Bangkok Dangerous? I don't know. Oh, no, that was The Eye, the movie The Eye. Sorry. Those are my main choices. But actually, Takashi Miike, the director, does a lot of, like, gangster-type films that are Asian cinema, and they're always really well done. So I would recommend just check out a lot of his catalog. Ley Lines, Shinjuku Triad Society, Dead or Alive, the first one. Deadly Outlaw Rekka. Obviously, I said Ichi the Killer already. There's some. Fudo.
Now, are these mostly Japanese movies?
Yeah, except for Bangkok Dangerous being a Thai film.
Right.
Yes.
Because I'm wondering if there might be a difference between... Because, I mean, when I saw this movie, it reminded me a lot of The Election, which is a Hong Kong movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very...
I haven't seen it, but I know what it is.
Yeah, it's a very slowly paced... It's very similar in a lot of ways. So I'm wondering if Refn wasn't looking at a Japanese tradition or a Thai tradition, but was looking at a Hong Kong tradition in terms of gangster movies.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are culturally different aspects to what a gangster film should have. You know, so, you know, like a lot I've seen, like, the Korean trilogy about vengeance that Chang-wook Park did.
Amazing.
Which is a fantastic, fantastic trilogy.
Unbelievable. Some of my favorite films, period.
Yeah. It's Sympathy... it's Old Boy.
The Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance was first, and then Old Boy, and then Lady Vengeance.
Then Lady Vengeance.
And Old Boy's the best. Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance is next, but really good. And Lady Vengeance is not as good as the other two, but still good. Quite good.
And those movies have a definite different feel than, like, the Korean movies are definitely a different feel than the Japanese movies, mm-hmm. are a different feel than the Chinese movies, are a different feel from the Hong Kong movies.
Right.
So it could be a question of what is Refn going from with what his actual references are, because would this film have worked better if it had not been set in Bangkok, but maybe have been set in Hong Kong?
No, just because I think it was just the story in general and the way it was written and shot. The thing is, when you're a filmmaker, you need to be able to understand if an idea you come up with is going to engage an audience or not. And I guarantee you show this film to 10 people, 9 of them are going to hate it. And Jordan's going to like it, you know? There's going to be that one person that does pull some meaning from it. But a lot of other people's like, I don't see anything there. And there's so many films out there that you could be watching that bring something new to the table, something interesting, that I don't want to waste my time. You know, people don't want to waste their time with things. I think it's good, actually, to use the example of the Revenge trilogy by Chan-wook Park to say there are very violent...
and very stylistically different.
Yes, films, yes. And they're very gangstery. And that's an example of... they took a relatively simple idea of revenge, but they add something to it. They make it compelling, they make it interesting. And in the end, all those films are about how unsatisfying revenge is to get.
Honestly, Sympathy or Lady Vengeance is the closest to actually finding closure for the main character. And she's the one who actually kind of gives up vengeance at the end.
And the other thing is, like, you know, like Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance shows that there are a lot of unfortunate circumstances that can happen to make situations worse and make people want to exact revenge on others when, if they knew the full context of the situation, they wouldn't want to. So those are prime examples of how you take a style, a genre, a simple idea, and you make it compelling. You make it something that's going to say something new, and it's going to be something to somebody. I just felt like Only God Forgives was only something to Refn and Jordan. I'm sure there are other people out there who enjoyed it like you did, because it has like 2.5 stars on Netflix Instant, yeah. I believe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for other like movie critics that I consult and everything when making my own movie choices, this was their number one film of the year last year.
Really?
Yeah.
I would. Yeah. I you know, and here's another thing. sometimes I do believe that when people are film critics, there's a certain level of pretension. And, you know, I'm sure I do that from time to time. I'm probably doing it right now. But I think that a lot of the times they'll find a movie that they know a lot of people don't like and say, I'm going to find something in this and make something out of it to say that it's the most amazing thing out of there, because I don't want to be with the mainstream. I want to be the person that comes out and says, guess what? You guys all watched this and hated it, but it's because you're stupid. Because there's so much more to it, and it's an amazing film, and I'm going to tell you why. Yeah. And I guarantee there are times when they're right about that, and they can point that stuff out. I don't think Only God Forgives is one of those.
I mean, all I can do is point out what I think is interesting in a movie.
And it's, like I said, it's great that you found all those things, and you definitely presented things to me that I didn't notice in the film. But even when you tell me about them, it still doesn't change my opinion. And I think that's a real telltale thing about what the writer-director did, is that even with these interesting subtleties in the film and these different ways to give you visual cues and signal what's going on in the film, even with that exposed, it doesn't interest me at all.
I wonder if you could look at this not so much as a movie that's about a story, and think of it as a movie that's an exercise in technique.
Well, then why are you making it?
Well, why are you writing etudes for classical musicians?
I don't know.
Because it's something that they need to do to extend their range, to experiment, to find what actually works for them in terms of their actual technique.
But do you release those things as actual films? You know what I mean? Like,
I can pull CD after CD after CD of nothing but of etudes or studies that are played by classical musicians. The etude of Fernando Sor, you know, who was this guitarist out of the Baroque period, you know, or you listen to Bach's piano etudes all the time in classical music. You know, it's something that is actually fairly commonplace.
I don't know. I just say that from a movie standpoint, if you're going to make an exercise in technique, don't make me watch this crap. You know what I mean? Like, don't release it and say it's like an actual film. Like, have some sort of disclaimer saying, you know, this is a boiled down film that's just down to the essence of how you can make a film, an exercise in different ways that you can make a film. And so I use these different techniques that may be new or I'm trying to develop or whatever. You know, put that out there instead of trying to trick a person into thinking that this is a movie that has some sort of story that's going to be wildly compelling. Because let's be honest, that's what everyone's looking for when they go to a film. They want to see something that entertains them or makes them think or does both of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, most people just want to see entertain and not think.
Right.
I like to think, and I want one that makes me think. This film actually did the opposite for me. It made me
drowsy.
Not think. It made me just turn to a bucket of rage because I was just like, I wasted an hour and a half watching something that I'll never want to ever see again, and I want to forget, basically, because it was that bad, in my opinion. The sad reality of film is that you're releasing it for an audience. And that's why if you're going to write stuff like this, it should just stay a script. Or if you're going to shoot it, you can show it to your friends, whatever, but theaters should not release, you know, like studios should not release this kind of stuff, in my opinion. You know, obviously there were probably enough people who found interest in it. It got like a 5.8 on Internet Movie Database, I believe, which really it isn't a very good rating, honestly. A lot of the films in that area are meh.
Yeah, well, I mean, most of the films on IMDb typically only hit 7 at most.
Yeah, 7. If you see a 7 on there, you should jump on that film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
People are like, amazing if it's 7. So I usually look at stuff at like 6 and up is like an accomplished film, a good film.
Yeah.
Anything below 6, I'm usually kind of like, eh. If it's close to a 6, like Only God Forgives, I got a 5.8, I was like, okay, you know, maybe it's going
to
be...
Well, you know, the funny thing was, when we were discussing what movies to watch next, I said, well, I kind of want to see this Only God Forgives movie. And you actually said, oh, well, I'm glad you picked that because I was interested in seeing that too.
I almost picked it. It had been in my Netflix instant queue for some time.
But obviously, now that you've had an opportunity...
Get some water, sorry.
Now that you've had an opportunity to see it, I'm sure it's like, delete.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. I couldn't wait to take that off my list. But... This is just my opinion, but I am very animate about it, that this movie is total crap. So, that is that. I'm not sure if I had... Oh, did you think you could find any hidden meaning to when Julian was cut his mother's stomach open and was sticking his hand in? I assume it probably had something to do with, like, his birth, whatever, him putting himself back inside of her.
Essentially, well, I don't think it was necessarily... putting something back inside of her as removing the thing that offended her.
Oh, yeah. Saying, metaphorically, here's your abortion that you wanted.
Yeah. And also, I mean, the idea of doing that is, you know, it was his final repudiation of, you know, the lies that his mother had told him for his entire life. Mm-hmm. It was like saying, look, okay, fine. I don't have to put up with your garbage anymore.
Well, that's one way to...
Yeah.
I mean, but he wasn't really proving anything to her because she was already dead. It was for him.
But that's the thing. His journey was for him. It wasn't to prove anything against her. And in fact, probably...
There you go. His journey was for him, just like this film was for the writer-director. It was his own journey that he wanted to do.
Well, and also, I'm kind of curious because Gosling actually just directed his own movie that's going to be released later this year. Hmm. So I'm wondering if they might have sat down and like went over directing techniques and everything like that. And so this movie might have actually been more for Gosling than it was for Refn to like give him an idea of how to put a film together.
Well, I should hope that he does not make a film anywhere close to this. Because I'm typically a big fan of Ryan Gosling.
I think honestly, his acting is of the highest pedigree. In fact, I think he's probably one of the most underrated actors in Hollywood right now. So yeah, to see him with someone like George Clooney in Ides of March, which I've already talked about my love of George Clooney as an actor. So Ryan Gosling with him, that was a fantastic movie. We should review that one, actually.
If it's available.
Yeah. It's a good political thriller.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It is. Well done. I mean, I think about all the movies that I love Ryan Gosling in, and there's just so many. I mean, he was great in The Ides of March. He was amazing in one of his earlier ones, United States of Leland. Half Nelson, which I saw and really liked. Drive, he was great in Drive,
yeah, obviously. I wanted to ask you, what do you think about Drive compared to this movie? Because it's the same director, same lead actor. And also a lot of the same film techniques.
Drive was good. I enjoyed it. The music was very well done. Very well done, the music, actually. Perfectly matched. That was one of those films that was slowly paced.
Yes.
But it justified itself in doing it because there was a story to tell. It was compelling. It was interesting. It was more... That was like a character piece that was properly executed. Only God Forgives is a character piece that... was like, okay, what are you trying to say? Like, why did I watch that? Like, what are you trying to tell me here? Nothing.
Red versus blue, Carl. Yeah. Red versus blue.
The whole thing is a metaphor for the director's feelings about Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
No, I think that's actually Rock'em Sock'em Robots. What was the name of that movie that was, what's his name? Wolverine. Hugh Jackman with robots fighting each other.
Oh, Real Steel.
Real Steel.
Yeah. Which there's a show called Robot Combat League, which is actually pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
They have one season. I don't know if they're coming back. I hope they are. It was better than I thought it would be. Anyway.
Well, I think we've pretty much said everything that we can say about Only God Forgives.
Do you want me to go first so that you can bring it up in your review?
I mean, to be honest, I'm not giving this a 4.5-star rating.
Right.
I thought it was an adequate movie. I didn't think it was the most amazing thing ever. But I did feel like I saw a lot more in the movie than you did, so mm-hmm. I just thought I would point those things out.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I'll go first then, and then you can give your better review of it. Okay, Only God Forgives. Terrible script. The story was not compelling on any level. A lot of the techniques used in it, the use of the music, it was severely mismatched. The fact that the acting was so over the top with most of the actors really was not good either. A lot of the characters were emotionless and one note, so no one can connect with anything in the film. Everything seemed to be kind of just whatever and for no reason. All the characters moved very slowly and stared at each other a lot, and honestly the whole film just felt like a staring contest between characters and a staring contest between the audience and the filmmaker. Nothing redeeming about this film, in my opinion. Absolutely nothing. There have been so many more films that go into this realm that are so much better. So anyone who hasn't seen it, who's watched this, I would personally say, don't bother. Refn, God, Refn. You know, I loved Bronson. Thank you so much for the film, Bronson. And he did Drive, apparently. Thank you very much for Drive as well. But I got to ding you hard on this film, because Only God Forgives is an atrocious train wreck of a film, in my opinion. And I give it half a star. It's the worst one I've watched out of all these. I actually like the Gogol Bordello documentary more.
That's amazing.
That's pretty bad.
You know what? We've actually had a pretty good run of movies that you haven't liked at this point.
Yeah. I knew it would happen at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, we got to find some way to swing that back up in the
I know how we should review Old Boy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we've
that'll
we both love Old Boy so much that I think we kind of been saving that as a rainy day movie.
This might be the time. I don't know. You got to bring me back from this one.
All right.
All right.
So I thought that this movie, the pacing was, like you said, slow. Very slow. What I found most interesting about the movie was the use of color. As I covered it, I thought that the color was a representation of anxiety versus assuredness, which is an interesting concept. I don't necessarily think that this is a revenge movie so much as a movie that repudiates revenge. So I think though that the repudiation of revenge came too early in the movie to make it interesting. And I think that you have too many characters that are trying too hard to be interesting by staring at things. You can only have like one really oddball character in a movie for it to really work.
But when they're all that way.
But when they're all oddball, then it's like, well, I feel like if you're going to have an oddball movie with an oddball cast, then you should just have a fantasy movie.
Yeah.
A straight up fantasy. And I love fantasy movies. The Fall is probably one of my favorite movies.
Oh, I haven't watched that yet.
Oh, man. You know what? I should just bring over the DVD and we should just watch it just for the sake of watching it, because it's
probably... I have the DVD. I've just not watched it. I have a lot of movies that I haven't watched.
You know, I had plans for this evening, Carlin.
Calling them off.
Yeah, you shouldn't have told me that. But I honestly think that this movie, for me, was worth watching once. And it was worth watching once because I liked the actor. And I thought, because like you, I thought Bronson and Drive were both very good movies.
Yeah.
So I was willing to give the director another chance with that kind of track record. And I still am. I'm actually going to... I saw Pusher is actually on Netflix. So I would like to compare his early work to his most recent work just to see what differences are there. Overall, I think that this is a 3-star movie. It's not anything that I think is going to revolutionize the world, mm-hmm. but I think that there's, you say that there's nothing here, I say that there's something here, and I think that's the big difference between our reviews.
Yeah. If you want to figure out what we are between, but
3.5.
Well, while you figure it out, I'll say that, you know, you said that you were willing to give Refn another try with a movie. And I don't think because of this movie that I would write Refn off. Because right. I would certainly give him more tries. Even more than one more try. Because, you know, he's already... You know, he's shown me the examples of films that he can make that I will enjoy. Two of them already.
Right.
So I'll definitely check out a lot of stuff from him. I would point to a great example of a director that I keep going back to who has real stinkers, but then he has really great stuff too. Takashi Miike. Yeah. I talked about him earlier. He pumps out movies. He does probably, usually averages around 7 movies a year.
Oh my God.
Right. He doesn't write any of his own stuff. Right. And that's one of the things. He just directs. He pumps out movies, and he is not very...
He sounds like the Ed Wood of Japanese cinema.
Kind of. He's not very strict about how a scene will be shot. He's even, in an interview, said that depending on the day, it's the scene's going to be different. It's just kind of like whatever. He flies by the seat of his pants. So he pumps out a lot, and he does some really terrible stuff, but he does some really awesome stuff at the same time. And sifting through it all to find the really awesome stuff is worth it. It's actually really funny because I love him as a director, and he's the polar opposite of the other Asian director I love, Chan-wook Park, who is so deliberate
is
about
very meticulous.
Everything.
Oh my Lord.
And he writes most of his own stuff.
Yes.
So it's just very funny to have, to love both of them, and they're total polar opposites.
Yes. Chan-wook Park just did his first English movie, Stoker,
which I have seen.
I have not, and I really want to see Stoker, because I've liked all of his other movies that I've seen.
I won't say anything about it.
So our overall rating for the podcast is 1.75. Is that the lowest we've ever gone?
Overall, maybe? Might be. Listeners, look back and verify.
We'll have to do a double check on that. But I enjoyed this review. Having such a difference of opinion, I think, led to a really interesting conversation.
I thought at one point you were going to kill me because you looked kind of pissed off. And some of the stuff I was saying, which is warranted, because I was spitting a lot of venom for a while there.
Well, the thing is, you don't mince words about your opinion. And that's something I've just come to expect from you, is that,
yeah, I'm very
that
loud.
If you have an opinion, you're going to let it be known.
Gets me in trouble sometimes.
Yeah, well, and I'm a very non-confrontational person, so that type of thing. If I have a bad opinion of something, I typically will say, I didn't think it was the greatest thing in the world, and just leave it as that. Whereas you're like, it's crap.
Well, so in this case, I was like, pile of shit.
Yes. And on that note, thank you very much for listening to Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night. Hope you have a good one.
You've been listening to Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night.
Our theme music was provided by Sweet Wave Audio. To find more royalty-free music for your own projects, check out sweetwaveaudio.co.uk.
And special thanks to Ariana Ramos for her graphic design savvy helping us with our album art.
Visit our website at mostexcellentmovienight.com to listen to other episodes, give us your opinion, and share with us other movies you'd like to have reviewed.
You can also contact us through our email address, mostexcellentmovienight@gmail.com. We would love to read them on the air.
Also, if you could rate and review the podcast on iTunes, we would be your friends for life.
For sure. That's all for now. Thanks for listening to Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night,
where movies are most excellent.
This has been a Nerd Circle podcast production.